Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
I do believe, I don't know when the bottom is going to be. I think there's good evidence that we're already there, but it's very possible 5 to 7 years from now, people are going to be looking back and saying, I really missed an opportunity because I wanted to be chasing the crowd more so than looking where, in a basketball analogy, playing to where the ball is going to be instead of playing where it is.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and a very special welcome to this episode of Finance U. I am your host, Chris Martinson. I'm back with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. And man, we've got a lot of things we really need to talk about. So, Paul, how's your energy today? Are we good?
It's good. It's good. I've had a good laugh right before we started, and it's such an honor to be here and have the conversation to help warn people.
I have to tell you, I'm chuckling in danger these days. I think I'm laughing because I have to. Things, Paul, are getting pretty dark, you know, what with the Epstein revelations. And it's not just about him. They're trying to pin it on one name, but it was a whole interlocking, organized group of people who are a lot of the same people involved in our markets. And I don't know. It's just, I've talked to a lot of people who are very disturbed by it. And so sometimes that social mood can sneak into the economy. And so I think we got to talk about a little bit of that today.
I think so. I mean, that's what I'm hearing. It's absolutely horrific. And it's amazing how the mainstream media is derelict in their duties to educate the people about what's really going on in the halls of power.
All I can figure is that the people who own those media companies are also somehow involved or complicit or covering up for people who they care about on some level, who are complicit in this whole thing. But it's pretty bad. The media is doing a terrible job keeping people abreast of what's happening. And there's a couple other areas I think they're not doing a good job at. We can get to those today as well. One, the Fed started printing again. They're worried about something, so maybe we can sort of speculate about that. And then two, AI is coming on like a freight train, and I want to just talk about what the implications of that might be over the next few years, because I think it's huge. So where do we start? Fed printing, AI jobs, economic stresses. So have you seen, I can skip ahead a little. This is a presser. Jerome Powell just did this. I can skip to about here, I think.
Absolutely there to take the actions that we said we would take. So, and we, those actions are today. So, you know, we announced that we're resuming reserve management purchases. That is completely separate from monetary policy. It's just we need to keep an ample supply of reserves out there. Why so big? The answer to that is, you know, if you look ahead, you'll see that April 15th is coming up, and our framework is such that we want to have ample reserves even at times when reserves are at a low level temporarily. So that's what happens on tax day. People pay a lot of money to the government. Reserves drop sharply and temporarily. So this seasonal buildup that we'll see in the next few months was going to happen anyway. It was going to happen because April 15th is April 15th. There's also a secular ongoing growth of the balance sheet. We have to keep reserves, call it constant, as it relates to the banking system or to the whole economy. And that alone calls for us to increase about $20-25 billion per month. So that's a small part that's going on. It's also happening in the context of a temporary few months front loading to get reserves high enough to get through the, you know, the tax period in mid-April. So that's what's happening there.
Oh, sounds a little boring, huh?
Yeah. Here,
if I was the sign language interpreter for what he just said, this is the international sign right here. come on. So blah, 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 blah. He's just said, look, we're printing again. We're back to printing. And he had this mumbo jumbo about reserve balances and tax day. And by the way, I've heard a lot of people say, at least on X, that they're not feeling too good about paying taxes anymore, given the other stuff we've just heard about. So mm-hmm. Maybe it won't be quite the reserve draining thing this year. Who knows? But can we just be clear about this? So they said they were only going to purchase $40 billion of T-bills in December of 25, followed by $20 to $25 billion per month after that. It turns out $40 billion in December and $70 billion in January already. And they are back to printing. And here's what he's talking about. What happened? They put all this money into the market, into the banking system because of COVID. And it became excess reserves. And then the Fed was hitting that with their reserve, reverse repo, blah, blah, blah. It turns out it's now the lowest level it's hit in 1,798 days, down 99.5%. So they're out of that ammo. So they're going to have to start printing again, and that's what they've started doing. I just think people need to be aware of that, because I've always said it's never a question. When they have to print, they'll print. There's never a question that they would allow things like their precious markets to show any sort of signs of prices going anywhere but up. They would never risk that. I don't know why it's gotten to that point, but the Fed is now actively managing and day trading the markets by making sure that the markets go up with plenty of liquidity. That's how I interpreted what he said. What do you hear?
No, I hear the same thing. I hear there's trouble on the horizon, and they're trying to make excuses on why they can start printing now to increase the momentum. And what's amazing to me is they're back to printing, but the S&P 500 has been flat. We're at the same level that we were approximately around October 13th. That is on the S&P. And then let's see here on the NASDAQ, we're at the approximate same level we were at the 1st of October. So the markets have just gone essentially nowhere, with retail piling in like crazy and then them, you know, providing liquidity again. So they must see something on the horizon that they're trying to get ahead of. You know, we got the midterms coming up, and the S&P matters a whole lot to Trump.
He's not being honest. They see something in there that says, wow, we're going to have to put more liquidity into the marketplace than we have been. Here's the chart of that. This is showing the Fed's balance sheet, which is when they print, they emit currency, but then they take something onto their balance sheet. So when they print, their balance sheet grows. And they had been winding it down because they didn't have to, because this is when they were chewing into all the excess money that they'd put out in the system. And it U-turned here on Wednesday, December 3rd, went the other direction. They did this huge immediate printing, which took it from $6.54 trillion to $6.64, $100 billion just a couple of weeks. They were able to undo some of that. But they've carried on here. And so now we're up a little over $100 billion so far since the 1st of December. So they're back to printing. Paul, I expect this to get really steep in an emergency. But they're already worried about something. When they're worried about something, I think maybe people should be a little extra cautious. That would be a time for caution, because they know stuff we don't know.
They know things we don't know, and they're not waiting until the event comes about anymore. They haven't since COVID, at least. They've just tried to front run everything across the board to make us all sunshine and rainbows when it comes to the markets. Mm-hmm.
But you know who's not displaying any nervousness? Retail. No. So when I say retail, just to be clear, maybe not everybody knows, there's institutional money that's in the markets, right? And then there's professional or managed money that's in the markets. Retail means you and me coming in, buying ETFs, buying individual stocks, like doing whatever we're doing. So when we say retail, we just mean not the big institutions, not managed money, the common folk, right? Strongest retail flows on record coming in here.
That's incredible.
Through to the, isn't that amazing?
It really is. And it just shows the lack of knowledge of what's taking place and can potentially go wrong under the surface with the average retail investor. And they're, you know, look, traditionally are the most bullish and the most bearish at the absolute worst times. I mean, go back and look where retail kind of went all in on that chart in late 2021. Mm-hmm. They hit their high in that range there. And then right at the market bottom in November of 2022, right before 2023 started, they had their largest amount of kind of outflows right there. So they get whipsawed at the extremes. And I'll tell you what's interesting, Chris. I've been going back and reading kind of some of the headlines around the Great Depression and the top of the market back in 1929. And one thing that was fascinating to me, and all the reading that I've had before, I didn't pick up on it, And maybe I just overlooked it, or maybe what I was reading, you know, highlighted this from the individual that was there. Even at the peak of 1928, 1929, there was the belief that retail was smarter than institution. And you know, retail is the new market. And we've been hearing this for quite some time because they're dealing off of emotions in a lot of cases. They don't necessarily have a long-term strategy. It's a feeling. It's a herd mentality. And they get the most bold at typically the worst time, a little bit of instant gratification. And when I see that type of money flowing into the market from retail, and then I want to show this chart of the S&P right now, because it's not impacting. So that much money is going in, but it's not driving these markets higher. So what I'm showing here, and if I need to expand this a little bit to make it a little larger, I will. But what I'm showing is a chart of the NASDAQ. The QQQ is represented by the NASDAQ, or QQQ, going back a year. So what we can see is this is where we are today. All of that retail flow hasn't been able to break us above resistance. Now, look, it may. We're in a consolidation period right here, but that's a different behavior than what we've seen in the past, and that tends to at least give us an indication we're close to a top, because you've got the Fed printing again, you've got retail going in like crazy, and we're still not able to pierce those highs that occurred back in November. We tested again in late January, and we're just consolidating in this range. And it's not only on the QQQ and NASDAQ. The same thing is occurring on the S&P 500. Now, S&P 500's tested several times here, and we're holding up in that trend line, but something's going to break one way or another. Either the Fed provides enough liquidity to where we get another rally that moves from here, or we're going to fail here and retail is going to really regret, you know, piling in with the confidence that they have here recently. I mean, that's a very concerning chart to me.
Well, let's talk about that market structure for a bit, just because I think this is really important, because the headline numbers haven't changed all that much. So I know you're showing the triple Qs there. That's technology. This is the S&P 500. And I think you can clearly see that we've sort of had this thing where we're moving from over here, and things are pushing from left to right. So technology over on the left, but consumer, defensive, industrials, utilities, real estate, energy, basic mineral. This is sort of your defense. This is everything. This is what's gotten the rotation here. Let me supersize that so we can see it more easily. Okay. And what we're seeing here is that push from, you see Microsoft down 17% on the year, Oracle down 19.9, Palantir 20.95 at the time I took the snapshot, but Walmart up 15, Costco up 17. So you can see that rotation. Same thing, we have a problem over here in software, big problem, Adobe, CRM, into, like, these guys are down hard, but a rotation over into what, industrials, farm machinery, you know? And then same thing, kind of out of financials, but we're coming over here into energy, basic materials. That's a sector rotation. So the overall market hasn't looked like it's changed that much, because the numbers are about the same. But underneath, we're seeing that sector rotation that says we're all that stuff that's been doing real well, we're getting out of that and we're getting defensive at this point in time. And it's against that backdrop that retail's like, woohoo, all in, baby.
Yeah.
You know, you got to know how to read the signs, I think.
And, you know, what most people don't understand is, even if you have an actively managed mutual funds, now ETFs tend to be the most popular trading vehicle now, just because of their efficiency, everything that's associated with it. But you have to read the prospectus on any mutual fund that you own, especially if you're a passive investor, and especially if you think that they're going to be, you know, actively or tactically managing risk. So if you're a manager that has some gray hair and you've survived over the past 20 years without being fired by the C-suite because you've underperformed the S&P by a couple of points, then you have to stay fully invested at all times. And if you see something concerning in the economy, you have to stay invested. So you're going to shift to the things that people need more so than what they want, your consumer discretionary, your staples, especially, to try to help hold up if we get into a recession and if the market comes apart. And that initial transition doesn't show up in the overall indexes because you're rebalancing underneath the surface. And then once that rebalancing has taken place, if unemployment picks up and that passive flow drops, that's when you get these major downturns in the overall market. So my question is, retail's all in. Has that provided the fuel for some of your major institutions to offload their positions that are just overvalued to reposition into other areas that they think will hold up better because of their mandate to be fully invested at all times.
All right. Well, Paul, I want to talk about that in the context of what I think is going to be a major shock coming up in these midterm elections. This has huge market implications. We'll talk about that as soon as we come back. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions.
All right, welcome back, everybody. So, Paul, we started out talking about this, that that, you know, there's these Epstein files, right? And what we know about them so far is that the DOJ has said there's nothing to see here, there's nobody's going to get prosecuted. And of course, there's some really awful things in there where obviously there should be a lot of prosecutions. And that's if we're being gentle about the whole thing. Point is that I've talked to a lot of people who voted Republican, voted Trump, and they're not going to go out and vote Democrat, but they're going to stay home. And so sometimes that's all it takes to have some, to, you know, one side stays home and the other side's activated. And I think we could see a thing where we end up with a, can you imagine? So this Trump administration is trying to do everything by executive order, can sort of get away with that because it owns the House and the Senate. But if it loses those, I think we get thrown into chaos. I see impeachments. I see tangled things. I see disagreements. I see gridlock at a time when I think we're going to need to be fairly nimble and fleet of foot. What are you thinking there?
No, well said. I mean, I've had conversations with individuals around that, you know, somebody was telling me the other day, they said, look, I've argued with all of my friends that are frustrated with the system that said voting doesn't matter. And they're like, yes, you have to cast your vote. And they're at a loss for their argument because we voted for this disclosure of the Epstein files, for truth and justice to come forward. But now all of a sudden the Republicans that they voted for, and there are some that actually had voted Democrat in the past that felt like the party left them and shifted over to the other side, and they're even more frustrated now. Like they just, they don't feel like they have any impact, and these leaders are not listening to the will of the American people. And when you look at the poll results of how many on both sides want to have justice to the Epstein files and have full release, they don't seem to care. So, you know, I'm with you. I'm very concerned that you're going to have people come out. And the question is, who in the world are you going to vote for in your district if you've got a Republican that's there that's not doing anything, or a Democrat that's not doing anything? Do we have any other alternatives? And can the average individual go fight against this big money that obviously is shown in the Epstein files tends to flow to the candidates that they want in a position of power? There's a lot of frustration out there. There's a lot of frustration. And it wouldn't surprise me if they just don't show up because they can't throw their hat in the ring for the person that they voted for because they haven't done what they said they would do.
Exactly. Well said. So I think this could, you know, again, we're just setting up. There's some market stresses here. There's some economic uncertainties that are going on. One of them, too, is this, which is the number of unsold but completed homes for sale. It's been spiking for a while, but it's now at the highest level since July of 2009. And so not super crisis levels, you know, I think it could go up quite a bit from here. But definitely we're seeing stress there. We're seeing a variety of stresses across housing is one area. And then the other area
we're seeing these stresses for me is boy, this is getting hard. So we all knew New York was going to have trouble with all this because this Mamdani guy would really like to spend a lot of money. So QE Infinity writing here this morning wrote, so you get hit with the 9.5% increase in property taxes, but only if you're rich, if you're earning $122,000 and higher. Right? Mamdani calls this upper and middle class tax hikes, and $122,000 in New York City doesn't even put a roof over your head. You're a poor. So essentially anyone owning any property is going to get hit. 9.5% increase.
That's incredible.
In property taxes.
That's on top of insurance increases, you know, property and casualty, health insurance increases, property and casualty increases. And he's so detached from reality on that. I mean, Mike Green goes out and lays out a great argument that you're only breaking even at $140,000 in income. So he's really tearing into some people there. And I also read a report that he's wanting to, you know, tap the reserves, several reserves that they have access to just to drain it down to spend. It's not going to end well.
No, and obviously they have a huge amount of probably waste, fraud, and abuse that they could tackle and get some savings out of. That would be trickier because then you'd actually have to manage and lead. And, you know, it's less fun than just taxing a bunch of hapless people who have no power in this situation. So if your local municipality decides to raise your property taxes, you have very few options, right? Sometimes you can go for an abatement, you know, which is to try and claim that your house isn't worth quite what they say it is. But when they jack your rate up on you, I'm not aware of having any recourse. Just pay it or lose your home.
I mean, that's exactly what's going to happen. And there's a lot of people that are going to be forced to make some hard decisions because they can't afford those homes anymore as these rates go up. And look, if he's starting that now, look, if we have an economic recession, how much worse is it going to get at some point in the future? I mean, I just don't see this slowing in any way whatsoever. He's just laid his hand out as to what he wants to do. Mm-hmm. And this is a warning sign that it's going to get worse.
Now, CPI doesn't really include, it does a bad job of wrapping in property taxes, insurance, things like that. According to the CPI, in this last one that they just released, electricity prices went down last month. Not according to every single anecdote I've collected so far.
No.
And second, they said that health insurance is down a little close to 1% year over year. It's like, nope, that's not what happened either. So they do a terrible job at it. So some people have turned to this other thing called trueflation, which measures a billion prices. Should be more accurate. Trueflation thinks inflation's gone all the way down to 0.69%. It can't be capturing that 9.5% increase. It can't be capturing reality. That includes, I think it does probably a fine job with like certain, like consumables, like I think it sort of trolls like the Amazon website and looks at the price of everything and has some algorithm for comparing this product to last year's or whatever it is. But in terms of insurance, taxes, things like that, it just clearly can't be capturing that.
And those are your larger ticket items too. Those are the things that, look, I've spent 28 years working with retirees. And the people, you know, I've had tons of people here recently that I've worked with for 25 years, 20 and 25 years. And one of them made the comment, says, you know, I believed you because you were so convinced that inflation was my greatest risk in retirement. And thank you for helping me prepare for it because it's really starting to bite now. The problem is, I mean, we, you know, back then I wasn't as awake as I am today and didn't run 5.5% and 6-7.5% inflationary pressures. I built in enough margin for error in their plans where they're able to absorb it. But it's serious on these people now that are 20, 25 years into their retirement and still healthy and still have the ability to travel. They're still living in the same home and their insurance cost is double. Their property taxes are double. Replacing cars, they're double what you could do 20 years ago. And those are the things that people need on a regular basis.
Right now, last night and into this morning, the United States military is sending a huge amount of airlifts over to the Middle East. The implication is that, well, you know, maybe we bomb Iran, and of course that may go all sorts of ways, some of them unpredictable. But if it turns into Iran retaliating in some way, or this sort of igniting the Middle East in some way, or the shutdown of the Strait of Hormuz, we could easily see oil prices spike in a very sharp way that would cause a shock to the economy, I think, at this particular stage.
Oh, that could be the death knell for the economy. I mean, imagine one thing that COVID revealed to us is we're a truly just-in-time inventory global economy. So if that was to escalate, Strait of Hormuz was shut down, and let's say China decides not to enter the war, but they decide to stop shipping things to us for a period of time. I mean, that in itself would cause massive amounts of damage to our economy. And we're in one of the weakest positions that we've been in quite some time. I mean, valuation levels on the market are priced to perfection. And if you don't get perfection, and a war that spirals out of control is certainly not perfection, then investors are going to be awakened to the reality of what downside risk and volatility can be to an overvalued market that's ridiculously complacent.
Yeah. And by the way, as we've talked about, for some reason, Exxon, like all this oil and gas, even though energy oil itself has gone nowhere, it's actually been in a sustained downtrend since 2022. But here, it's just for some reason, these are up strongly. I think somebody knows something is coming here that could cause oil to go up in price.
Maybe there's a lot of people that knew something that had that initial burst in allocating to gold and metals and real things. And yeah, we've probably seen a needed correction in the price, but it's pulled back because maybe they've taken their initial positions and they're happy with where they are right now to be prepared for whatever they see coming that's being planned in the halls of power.
Or it could just be, you know, it's that time of the cycle, right? Meaning
right.
that commodities to equities, it's a ratio of the two versus the U.S. dollar. And so here we see in blue, that's the U.S. dollar. So that's a real trade weighted index. So that's on the right hand scale here. And then also commodities compared to equities. And you see, we had this huge bottom down here in the early mid 80s. And then we had another big bottom down here, 95 to 99 ish. But this one is the lowest we've ever seen. The commodities have been absolutely out of favor since 10 years, easy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the answer is, once you bottom, it tends to do that, tends to sort of spike and off you go. So we'll see. The Plaza Accord was the top of the dollar there. The tech bubble in 2000 was the top there. Is the same thing? Are we going to see the same thing with the tech bubble here? Don't know.
That's a good question. I mean, Trump's been clear that he would like to see a weaker dollar. And that chart, I want to point out, Chris, you know, Warren Buffett, it sounds easy. You know, Buffett's quotes are so clear and easy. He says, be scared when everybody is greedy and greedy when everybody is scared. So when you look at that, where's an area, if you take that in application from a long-term standpoint, where we should be greedy and start accumulating assets from a diversification standpoint, is certainly into those commodities, because we need them from a long-term standpoint. If we get a weaker dollar, that's rocket fuel for them. And we're underinvested in energy production based on where AI is going at this point. I do believe, I don't know when the bottom is going to be. I think there's good evidence that we're already there, but it's very possible 5 to 7 years from now, people are going to be looking back and saying, I really missed an opportunity because I wanted to be chasing the crowd more so than looking where, in a basketball analogy, playing to where the ball is going to be instead of playing where it is.
Well, one way to sort of play this, obviously, would be the twofer, which would be to invest in commodity-rich emerging markets, or I don't know if it's right to call Brazil an emerging market, but, you know, it seems more advanced than that. But at any rate, investing in a place like Brazil, where, you know, they have a lot of commodity exposure, and also they're not dollar exposed, except inversely. So you could get, you know, sort of a twofer. U.S. equities have been performing badly compared to the rest of the world this year.
This year. Well, really going back to January 1st of 2025. So it's been a year and 2 months now.
Oh, really? Okay. Goes back that far.
Yeah. Yeah, so let me pull that up, because it is worth taking a look at now. I'll have to maneuver a couple of things around, so bear with me while I get to the chart. But yeah, that leadership goes back to, okay, I don't have Brazil on this chart, but it does show your major overall indexes here, just to put that in perspective. And okay, had a hard time getting my screen to share there, so bear with me. So this is just kind of your major indexes, okay? So if we go back over here, the blue line, okay, that has underperformed the S&P. The blue line is the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, and this goes back to January 1st, 2025 until today. So that one hasn't lifted off yet. The black line here that you can see and the red line are the NASDAQ and the S&P 500, but that purple line right there is developed international markets, and the pink line here is emerging markets. So if you go back to January 1st of 2025 till today, EEM ETF is up 50.6% versus the S&P 17 and the NASDAQ right at 19. And of course, gold is up there. So that started really last year. Commodities have had liftoff recently. So in the past year and a half, commodities in general have underperformed. But if we come take a look at it year to date, so this is December 31st of 26, so I can capture the first trading day of the year. S&P is up 0.83, NASDAQ is down 0.85, the commodity index is up 7.6, that purple line, which is developed international, is 9, emerging markets are up 12.4. And I'm with you. I haven't looked to see if Brazil is still classified as emerging market, but they're not. Now, Peru, Chile would be emerging market. I don't think Brazil is. Yeah, I think I have to disclose this to be fair, but Brazil is in our on some of our strategies, and it's been in there for a while because it looks so attractive. I mean, price-earnings ratios are ridiculously low. Dividend yields are high. From a long-term standpoint, money flow is moving into that area, which is one of the reasons it's been a target in some of our strategies. So, you know, full disclosure, we do own it. I'm not talking my book, but I do have to disclose that.
And those returns you showed, are those exclusive of dividends?
No, these are just they're not counting dividends.
So that's what I mean. They're ex dividend. Like they don't count the dividends. So that could even be
right.
More of a juice on this if they're, you know, yielding many points higher than the S&P dividends, which is not hard
Correct.
To do.
No, and I'm curious now. I haven't committed to memory what EEM. Dividend yield is. So I'm going to pull it up and look at it. I know Brazil's in the 7% range. EEM's 2.48. EFA is, as of today, 3.3. And Brazil is represented by EWZ. My feed must not be right because that dividend's higher than 0.83. But yeah. So that's just your total return, not your total return. It's total return. It's return X dividend.
All right. Well, this is kind of late cycle behavior, but, you know, U.S. household debt hits a new record, $18.8 trillion in Q4 25, you know, just piling it on. This was the great deleveraging and the great financial crisis, and then, you know, back to the races here. And so it's really been piling it on. But what's interesting, are people piling on this debt because, you know, they feel really good about things, or do they have to just to sort of stay alive? You know, what's actually happening here? So you can see it. This is sectioned out by colors, and those colors are age groups with 70 plus on the bottom. And then it's by decades. That would be 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, and then 18 to 30 is that top one. So I'm looking at this like, who's piling it on here? Who's carrying a lot? Well, the 30 to 40 crowd, the 40 to 50 crowd, and the 50 to 60 crowd. Those are the biggest three buckets on there. Trillions and trillions and trillions of debt. And that's household debt. So that's, you know, a lot of, yeah. But then how about this? So they're not paying their student loans back. So that was the Biden moratorium, that big U-shaped bottom there on the canyon. But you saw it was kind of lurking along there between 8 and 10% for a while, wobbled up as high as 12 there around 2013-14. But basically, let's call it sort of hanging at 10%. Now it's 16.3%, our 30 delinquent 30 days or more. Just seems like people are not all that interested in paying back their student loans for some reason.
No, and with the interest rates that they're paying and the fact that they cannot default on that debt, I mean, that's one of the only ones that you can't walk away from bankruptcy. And a lot of the ones that I've seen have been in the 7 to 10% range, which I think is just absolutely horrific because of the safety, the ability to garnish wages and Social Security, you name it. They have their ways of getting that money back.
They should be the cheapest. They should have the lowest rates of any loan outstanding.
Absolutely.
Based on that.
It should be the same as treasuries or lower because of the fact that, you can't default on it. I mean, there's no risk for the lenders there. You're going to get paid back. It's just a matter of when.
Yep.
So, you know, and that's just adding to the burden and the stones in the backpack that these overleveraged that were promised that their education was going to, you know, give them all these great salaries. And, you know, you talked about it the last week. I've had a couple of comments over that, that it encouraged some of the younger listeners out there of the reality of what they're facing, how hard it is for these graduates to get jobs.
Well, I want to talk about that directly because I think this is actually one of the biggest, most existential risks that we're facing as a nation, maybe as a species, and in particular, how it pertains to jobs and all of that. I'm talking about AI. So as soon as we come back, Paul, I want to talk about that. Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. Welcome back, everybody. So, Paul, you know, at Peak Prosperity, I've switched my format a little bit. I have lots of content, as you know, comes out all the time, but I'm switching to one big meaty report a month, you know, really burrowing into that and doing it right. And this month's report coming out at the end of February is about AI. And there's a lot of elements to that I'm going to unpack. And of course, I'm going to connect it to ideas like I do. We have to understand complexity theory, have to understand this thing called common knowledge game. So it's just some ideas so we can get our heads around it. I don't think this is even remotely closely enough appreciated just how crazy this is, this thing we're about to be facing. So I just want to talk about a piece of that because as it pertains to jobs, because this pertains to markets.
Okay,
hold on. Let me pull this up again. So this is from Diary of a CEO, this guy, great interviewer, and he's got this guy, Yampolsky, on here, who's been in AI forever and ever, doing safety, and let me make sure this is all the way up, and here he's going to talk about jobs for a second.
I'm not driving the car at all. I mean, obviously, in LA, we also have Waymo now, which means you order it on your phone, and it shows up with no driver in it and takes you to where you want to go.
Oh, yeah.
So it's quite clear to see how that is potentially a matter of time. If for those people, because we do have some of those people listening to this conversation right now, that their occupation is driving, to offer them and I think driving is the biggest occupation in the world, if I'm correct. I'm pretty sure it is the biggest occupation in the world.
One of the top ones, yeah.
What would you say to those people? What should they be doing with their lives? Should they be retraining in something or... what time frame?
So that's the paradigm shift here. Before, we always said this job is going to be automated, retrained to do this other job. But if I'm telling you that all jobs will be automated, then there is no plan B. You cannot retrain. Look at computer science. 2 years ago, we told people, learn to code. You are an artist, you cannot make money, learn to code. Then we realized, oh, AI kind of knows how to code and getting better. Become a prompt engineer. You can engineer prompts for AIs. It's going to be a great job. Get a four-year degree in it. But then we're like, AI is way better at designing prompts for other AIs than any human. So that's gone. So I can't really tell you right now the hardest thing is design AI agents for practical applications. I guarantee you in a year or two, it's going to be gone just as well. So I don't think there is a, this occupation needs to learn to do this instead. I think it's more like we as a humanity, then we all lose our jobs. What do we do? What do we do financially? Who's paying for us? And what do we do in terms of meaning? What do I do with my extra 60, 80 hours a week?
You've thought around this corner, haven't you?
A little bit.
What is around that corner, in your view?
So the economic part seems easy. If you create a lot of free labor, you have a lot of free wealth, abundance, things which are right now not very affordable become dirt cheap, and so you can provide for everyone basic needs. Some people say you can provide beyond basic needs. You can provide very good existence for everyone. The hard problem is, what do you do with all that free time? For a lot of people, their jobs are what gives them meaning in their life, so they would be kind of lost. We see it with people who retire or do early retirement. And for so many people who hate their jobs, they'll be very happy not working. But now you have people who are chilling all day. What happens to society? How does that impact crime rate, pregnancy rate, all sorts of issues? Nobody thinks about. Governments don't have programs prepared to deal with 99% unemployment.
99% unemployment. So this is such an, but this is going to, I don't know how to analyze this in terms of impact on markets.
Yep.
Because it raises some fundamental questions like, what is money if nobody has to work? Like, what even is it? Because it's sort of that arbiter of I produce, I have excess, and I save. And that's been the deal for 10,000 years. We've been refining our relationship with money, built systems around it, all sorts of ideas, understandings, beliefs. It's in our culture. For that to go away potentially in 2 years is too fast. Again, Paul, I don't care if you get from the top of the Empire State Building to the bottom in an elevator, but if you fall off of it, it's not the destination, it's the pace, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody's ready for this at this stage. I don't know how to analyze it yet.
No. No. And you have to struggle to actually keep that thought in your mind, because at first it's terrifying. I've been meaning to listen to that interview and I've not listened to it yet. It's been on my to-do list. And I mean, he lays it out clear. If AI is actually reaching that level, then what in the world are people going to do? And what is society going to look like that's keeping people from... you know, it takes me back to thinking of one of the things that I've consistently seen people struggle with in retirement, to the point that, you know, I try to have these conversations around, but there's two aspects. So one, I've had people in the years in past that have worked so hard throughout their life. They reach retirement and they sit and watch TV all day. Okay. And those people don't live very long. They just don't live very long. I mean, a couple of people that went from great health to sitting and watching TV all day, within 5 years, they were passed away. The ones that find hobbies or volunteer in the community, they tend to live the longest because they're actively doing something and it gives them meaning into their life. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is one of the funniest stories I've ever seen, because it was extreme. I had this new couple that came in, and we had worked with them about 2 or 3 years before they could get to retirement. They meet their day. They're big cut-ups, picking on me all the time. We laugh so hard, my stomach hurts the next day. And 6 months into, we had something we had to talk about, papers to sign, so they came in. 6 months into their retirement, and the tension in the room was palpable. To the point that I'm sitting there thinking, did I forget to do something? Like, did my team drop the ball? You know, because it was unusual for them. So as soon as they got up and walked out the door, I went to Brittany and I said, Brittany, go check and make sure that we've done everything we were supposed to do. There's nothing I can think of. So after she gets done, she said, no, there's nothing that we've dropped the ball on that we know of. I said, okay, I don't care what the excuse is, but in 3 months, I want you to reach out and pull them back in. I want to make sure if there's something that we can do better, right? So they come in, they're back to themselves again. So I just, me being me, I said, so I explained the situation. I said, so what's going on? They started laughing. They said, oh, about that. Said, we've been happily married for 35 years, but we've never spent that much time together. On vacation we have, but they said, you know, several months into retirement, Like, neither one of us had a hobby. Neither one of us were volunteering. And we found out we were bickering all the time. And the day before, they had decided to go kind of get some help for counseling. And the recommendation was made, said, you go volunteer at the local community where you want to. They eat lunch together. The wife would go hang out with her girlfriends for a couple hours. And then they get back together, and then they slowly work into that much time. Now, that's an extreme, you know, situation, but it's something that I saw enough to where I joke with people about that in retirement. So it gets them, before they get to retirement, start thinking about that, because it's the reality. So you take that immediately across the board in society. What in the, how much stress is that going to cause to people with this perceived utopia where, hey, I'm not going to have to work all the time? And I, too, I mean, I love to fly fish, but I have come to the conclusion that 14 days of fly fishing is about as much as I can possibly handle, because I tried it one time. Mm-hmm. You know, so too much of something is not a good thing, just in the way that we are made. And you know, what was the curse in the Garden of Eden? By the sweat of our brow and thorns and thistles, we will till the soil. So that's a part of our experience in this world, that we need that struggle. Otherwise, I'm concerned idle hands will have people bringing about a society that is much worse than the evil we're seeing lurking around the edges now, especially if we're not prepared for it. And if it comes that fast, your analogy is phenomenal, because it's going to hit people in the mouth like a baseball bat, and we're just not equipped to do that.
Well, we don't have the language, the tools, the customs, the wisdom, the experience to manage this. Like, this thing is coming on like a freight train. And I don't know if people can go look this up, but if you look at, like, say, China just had their year celebration, right? New Year celebrations. And so they put on quite the show, right? They're really big into their spectacles, ice palaces and dances, and giant, you know, really, really kind of impressive stuff. But this year they had robots on the stage dancing and conducting, running parkour and flipping and doing nunchucks that look just like humans, right? Very fluid. Last year they were sort of waving flags and falling over, right? This pace of this change is extraordinary. So when we had the Industrial Revolution, we basically said, wow, we can replace muscle power with this machine power. But from that first steam engine in 1850, whatever it was over there, to the last displacement of the last horse team was probably closing in on 100 years, right? It just took decades. These people are talking about replacing not labor, but cognition. So if we already don't need humans for labor, because tractors, I'd much rather have a tractor than 50 people harnessed to a plow, trust me, right? You know? So if we don't need labor, and we also don't need our brains, So this is where I'm struggling to sort of understand what the impact of all of this is going to be. So what did we see right up here? You know, we saw that software is already getting crushed, because you know why? It's starting to write software. So this, I think, is an early casualty right here. But we could see this all across the mix. So very, very difficult to analyze what this means. But at a minimum, we start here. Unemployment rate, or underemployment rates for recent college grads is going up. It's about 45% right now. It's just a terrible number. It's really not good.
No.
So
no.
I think this is already, we're seeing this early impact. Like, they're just not getting hired in. But I get it, you know. So one of the things, like, when I was coming out of business school, one of the, you know, plum assignments people sort of would angle for, one would be Wall Street and the other would be consulting, right? You know, go to Booz Allen, McCain, Bain, or one of those, McKinsey, or one of those big ones, right? We don't need those people anymore.
No.
Those jobs are toast at this point.
Yeah. And I would say that there's going to be a lot of counselors needed to help people work through this, but apparently AI seems to be counseling people at this point already anyway.
It does, and indeed.
Look, you know, and the concerning thing is, you know, with the robotics capability, if AI is coming along that quickly, they can side your house, they could roof your house, they could put the brick up, they could paint the house. There's all kinds of things that these robotics could do. I mean, even from landscaping, you know, I mean, there's been, GPS and large operations for farming for quite some time, and you add AI capabilities on top of that, if it is progressing that fast, you're right. I mean, he's right. He sees that 99% of the jobs will be affected. I'd like to know what that 1% is, because, you know, if that 1% is left, then everybody that's going to be trying to get trained in that direction is going to drive those salaries down. So even if you're in the right place, you've got 99% of the population trying to compete for your job, which is basic supply and demand, which drives the prices down.
Yep. Yeah. You know, I was on this panel. I was invited on this panel, I don't know, 10 years ago or so. And it was being conducted by a center down in Florida. And he assembled all these people. There was people from NASA there and work experts, because it was on the future of work, right? I'm there talking about my stuff, which is, well, look at these resource issues, and that's going to have its own impact. So they're just trying to answer the question, what is the future of work? And what stood out to me, there was this DARPA guy over there, bearded guy, nice guy. But he was just, this was way before AI was anywhere on my radar screen at all. And he said, within our lifetimes, the only thing that humans can do that AI won't be able to do is give a human back rub. And I was like, oh, come on, you know, but this guy obviously was seeing things before I was seeing them, right? Like, he obviously saw these models. So this is kind of concerning, because you have all these people coming out now, Paul, like all the AI CEOs, and they're all saying the same thing, which is kind of like a very high non-zero chance that this ends catastrophically for humanity, right? And that's like, that's a little apocalyptic, but they're just expressing that AI is starting to do things that we can't predict. It just has emergent behaviors. We don't quite know what it's doing. It's now a black box. Stuff is happening in there, but we don't know anymore. It's not entirely in our hands. And you could imagine that in a variety of scenarios, kind of going off the reservation. So for me, I think that, you know, from a financial standpoint, we got to go back to some of the stuff we talked about in The Great Taking, which is keep paper records of your things, right? Good practice, good financial hygiene, once a quarter, however, whatever frequency you feel comfortable with, make sure you download all your bank statements, your brokerage statements, get them all and put them in a file. And next quarter, throw that file out and, you know, put your new one in. Just because, you know, if systems somehow get a little flaky, you should have those records on hand.
Yes. And ideally in cold storage somehow, in case there's a hack that it's not erased.
I meant you're putting them in paper.
Oh, paper, yeah.
I'm going old school.
That's right, paper. So we actually have as a part of our policy to download all statements now when they're generated, and it's automated. Now, I do put it into cold storage just because it'd be so much from printing, but for individuals, it's a good idea to print it out on a regular basis too. That's good advice.
So you download all those things in PDFs and put them in a disk and then unplug the disk and put it somewhere?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yep.
Good practice.
So, you know, and Chris, when you hear that, I came across a quote the other day. So it was Friedrich Nietzsche. So Nietzsche, you know, the quote from there, he stated that most people are not seeking truth. They're searching for comfort and illusions. And I think it's more important right now for every one of us to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, embrace courage, and be willing to accept the truth and follow that truth wherever it'll take us. Because that truth may not necessarily give us the ability to change the path that AI is going upon, but it will help us be mentally prepared and adaptable to walk away from our hindsight perception. One of the weaknesses that Rolf DeBelli talks about in his book, The Art of Thinking Clearly, is your hindsight bias. So we tend to look in the most recent past and project into the future that's the way things will always be. And, you know, when it comes to this, we've just got to be open-minded. We have to follow the truth wherever it takes us and be adaptable and constantly searching. That's what I do for people. You know, we got to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us, and you have to keep your emotions in check and implement a strategy. But I spend a large majority of my time looking out and going, okay, what can go wrong? And how many ways can it go wrong? And what can go right? And how many ways can it go right? And what indication do we have that things are starting to go wrong? and we have to change our stance and opinion. Things are moving so fast now that it's hard for people to keep up with, and we feel that temptation to become overwhelmed. And it's a real temptation. I mean, heck, I face it from time to time. I remember the first time I read the book, The Great Taking, like I was like, I got to sit on this for a day or two. And then you found out about it at the same time. It's like you just have to process it. So, you know, thank you for warning people, because we have to know about this. And I'm looking forward to your report, because that's something that I've kind of put on the side burner for the because I knew you were working on it and I wanted to see that report coming out. And you said it's the end of the month.
Yep, it'll come out end of next week. So, but this is the most important thing, right? That mainstream media, you know, CNN and all that stuff, and New York Times and everybody, they're busy trying to convince us that some missing grandma is the most important thing right now. And I'm not saying it's unimportant, but compared to what we're talking about right now, it's unimportant, you know, in the scope of most people's lives. So this thing we're talking about, it's going to impact everybody. It's going to have to impact the conversations we have with each other, with our kids, with our grandkids. Like, it raises some very existential sort of questions at this particular stage. And I'd feel better if we had some grown-up supervision going on. But it's just, you know, if you've ever seen, like, some of these CEOs, like Sam Altman or Alex Karp talk, you're just like, ugh. These are the people making the decisions, you know, it's like, really, you know, and if people don't know who we're talking about, you just watch these people and you don't get a sense of well-adjusted, compassionate humans. They're a little bit disconnected from from emotional, like, normal pathways that people might have. But it's going to have, obviously, on private sector jobs, but I'm wondering if we aren't starting to see, I mean, obviously, Trump has been, like, doing what he can to walk down federal employees, all employees federal. That's a pretty big drop-off right there. We're back to levels we haven't been to since the mid-60s. Government jobs, Paul, I think are some of the most vulnerable, potentially, to AI. DMV, completely automatable, right? Just think of all the functions of government. It's pretty much automatable at this point. I think most, because it's really just, we have these rules. They're pretty arcane. Somebody has to know how to administer those so that those get, you know, affected out here in the world, according to plan. I think those are perfect to be replaced mm-hmm. by machines.
And in a lot of cases will be unfortunately, much more pleasant to deal with. Yeah.
Fair, you know, yeah. And pleasant even, you know.
Yeah.
But that's coming. So at any rate, just wanted to raise that, because that's a really big deal, mm-hmm. what we're facing right now. So,
well, and one thing I want to point out, maybe they do end up with one ring to rule them all, right? Mm-hmm. But the reality is you've got China working on their AIs. That's moving at light speed in the robotics and manufacturing. The U.S. is working on something else. I mean, there's going to be multiple companies that are out there on the other side of this, and we're just caught in between. We've just got to do the best that we can do to be courageous, to make adaptations that are wise as they come along, and develop some plans so that we're at least two steps ahead of the average individual to try to protect ourselves, our families, and our communities.
Yep, indeed. So as we come into the end, you know, people saw that, you know, silver and gold took a bit of a breather here, at least in the U.S. paper markets. We have the Chinese New Year, which ends soon, and so they'll get back. We'll see what they think of these new lower prices. But still, both of those, gold and silver, up strong for the year. It's hard to remember, you know, when it was higher and now it's lower. It's hard to remember where we came from, you know? I remember when we were like, ooh, 50 for silver. Can we break 50, you know, and off we went.
That was an amazing run. But again, look, this is the volatility that occurs when you're in a change. And, you know, look, I don't see signs right now that our currency is collapsing. That's obviously on the radar. Mm-hmm. But that perfect chart that you showed going back and showing the price of gold in German marks leading up to and into the German hyperinflation with multiple 25 and 50% declines. I mean, you've done a great job of warning people. I hopefully have done a good job of telling people there were going to be stomach-wrenching declines. But what we have to question is, have the fundamentals changed? And from everything that I'm looking at from a long-term standpoint, the reason to have owned the metals a year and a half ago is no different than it is today. As a matter of fact, we have more evidence to lead us to believe that the thesis for owning it is stronger. But there's going to be volatility in there. And this is what happens. It shakes people out. It shakes weak hands out, which gives the institutions and the governments of the world, they're still buying, right? The Federal Reserves of the world are still buying. So, so this is just part of bull market moves, really. It's part of what it is. And I think, I don't know what the price is going to be 6 months from now. I could build the argument that it's going to test the patience of those long term. But if I'm looking 2 to 3 years out, the information is still pointing in the direction that prices will be higher 2 to 3 years out. And if you're an investor, you know, traders are different than investors. Investors have to constantly check their thesis and look on where the ball is most likely to be. And if the information changes, you change your stance and your opinion.
Well, we have paper markets for everything, right? Corn, soybeans, cotton, copper, oil, gold, silver. Like we have these paper markets, and these, I call them paper markets. They're not really, they're just electronic representations. Most of those market volume right now from almost all of these things is driven by speculators. I plan to sell you a contract for soybeans. I don't have any, but I sell you one, and you have no interest in taking delivery of any soybeans ever, right? But still, we're busy trading, you know, on the price of soybeans, right? Even though we don't have any. So it was interesting. J.D. Vance came out a couple days ago and said, oh, the United States wants to establish itself as a trading block for critical minerals. And I'm like, well, we would have to have some, you know, if you really wanted to be taken seriously. I think the rest of the world's starting to notice that we're just, it's all fugazi. Like we pretend like we have all these things, but we don't really have the things we're trading and setting the prices for. So I expect the rest of the world to sort of sidestep us. You know, China will make independent straight deals with mines, with Brazil, mm-hmm. with Russia. They'll just do it independently and avoid this. I don't know how we could have a trading block sort of a activity here in the U.S. unless we reformed our markets to make them actually be places where price discovery happens instead of mm-hmm. price setting. Which is mm-hmm. should be illegal, is illegal, but it happens almost every day in these markets. Somebody just trounces in there with lots of paper, whatever, silver, and sets the price.
Right.
Which doesn't engender trust and warmth.
No, it doesn't. And unfortunately, the Epstein vials have revealed to us that there are those that are above the law. At least at this point, they are absolutely above the law because there's been no indictments, no consequences, no, with some of the most horrific things that I can't even believe that I'm having to process mentally, that you know humanity has the capability of doing it, but has been done in the halls of power with boldness to even put it into emails, right? I mean, I was told a long time ago, don't put anything into an email that you're not willing to be on the cover of the local paper, right? And they're emailing these things back and forth. But the problem is that, you know, price discovery is an honest market. Price determination is a dishonest market. We need to get back to honest markets. We need to get back to honesty across the board so that we have equal scales for the individual that's emerging, coming out of college, and the one that's in the halls of power. And right now, we don't. They've stacked. The closer you are to the printing presses, the greater advantage you have. And for the rest of us out here, you just have to question everything that they tell you, the propaganda they push upon you, especially the passive investing thing. Develop a strategy, play by the rules that are forced upon you, because we can't make the rules, so we have to implement prudent management of the resources that we've accumulated as best we can in the rules that are forced upon us, and do it in a wise, prudent, and discerning manner. And it can be done. It's not easy, but it can be done. Most people just don't want to do the work or have the desire to do the work to do it efficiently and prudently and consistently over time. Because you got to learn to get your emotions in check. You have to feel the fear and do it anyway when the weight of the evidence tells you it's the right thing to do.
Very well said. And just to point out to people what we were talking about here, this is silver. This is starting on the 18th. So that's yesterday. Sorry. So this is the 17th here.
this is what happened. Here we are in the overnight markets. Silver's just sort of, this is trading, comes up, goes down, people are trading. All of a sudden, somebody starts to put their foot on the gas pedal, and you can see here, since this is 1,000 contracts right here, so that's nearly, it's a 1,400 contracts. So that's about 7 million ounces of silver was sold in a single five-minute candle. 5 minutes of time. And so that's just like a huge smash, and then it sort of bounces back, and then this smash. These are what we call price setting. If you were legitimately, Paul, had a position you wanted to get out of, you would never push the sell button at 8 o'clock at night and throw them all into the market at that exact moment, because you would get the absolute worst price, unless your intent was to make the price go lower. That's price setting, not price discovery. And so we saw smash after smash, smash. Look at these big giant bars, right? So that's what, and you know, do we actually have that much silver to sell? No, no, we don't. The United States hardly produces any on a worldly basis. It's not 5%, maybe 7% of world mine output is in the U.S. So anyway, we're constantly selling stuff we don't have.
Right.
And if you said, okay, Paul, you said, hey, Chris, there's this farmer's market here in LJ. These people cheat you every time. But right across the street, there's this other one, Honest Weights and Measures. It's good stuff, high quality. Which one you want to go to?
You're going to go to the honest one.
Every time.
Especially as soon as you understand that information. And I had read a report, speaking of that, that in one of the most recent price smashes, that the Shanghai Exchange removed the trading licenses of two of the big players over there that participated in it. They're trying to purge all the manipulators off of their market, which is absolutely fascinating.
They don't put up with this. They're like, they saw this happen and like, nope, sorry, you're out. That's not a legitimate way to run a market.
We don't see that happen in the U.S. at all.
Mm-mm.
Now, I've not heard of it. Have you? I may be wrong, but I did a quick search the other day. I haven't seen a report of anybody's license being removed for any action like that.
No,
but
no.
Doing it.
Quite the opposite. I've seen where they've worked, the regulators have worked to protect the people who are doing the very thing that they probably ought to have been frog marched for.
And you may know this data, but one of the most recent reports that I saw is we're only pulling out of the ground now, what, 8 ounces of silver for every 1 ounce of gold? What has the historical ratio been, Chris? Do you know?
15 to 17, depending on who's counting.
Okay.
Something like that.
So we're pulling out half what we did in the past when it's related to silver, but people are willing to paper sell that much that quickly in thin markets. That's not... You know, you don't last on Wall Street that long, and you don't keep clients very long if they call you to sell something and you sell it at the most illiquid time. I mean, for us, we have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that you're getting the best price that you possibly can when you're buying or selling something. So you work orders in a thin market, and you work yourself out of a position in a thin market, whether you're buying or selling, so that you're trying not to impact that price substantially, so that your customer, your client, your firm, if you're managing money, gets if you're doing it for a firm level, gets the best price that's out there. That's the one thing that's a red flag to me that just doesn't make sense, why you would be selling massive amounts in a market where there's just not that many people there. If I'm, let's say I've got a one-of-a-kind 1968 Camaro. I don't want to go to an auction with 10 people unless they're 10 billionaires, right? I want them fighting against each other. I want to go to an auction with 2,000 people or more so that you have those individuals in the market that are going to pay you the highest price for that vehicle. The markets aren't designed to work that way, and price setting is the most likely outcome, as you stated.
Yeah, and that's, again, supposed to be illegal for obvious reasons, because a core component, like we derive a lot of benefit, any country does, when you have a functioning capital market. And if you happen to be the world's capital market, you know, this is the place where people come, it confers an extraordinary advantage to your country, right? You have deals and liquidity, and like it's good stuff. But if you wreck that, I don't see how it comes back really quickly. You know, it'd take a long time to regain that trust. And by then it might have moved kind of permanently to Singapore or Hong Kong or somewhere else, right? You know?
Yeah.
Capital goes where it's treated best every time.
And look, unfortunately, a large majority of the baby boomer population has you know, came up where they believed that they could trust the media that was earned apparently at some point in history. Now, we have enough information to say, see the deterioration and when it started to occur, but for the most part, they could trust it. And they're, you know, and that's been taken advantage. So one of the things that I tell my, somebody told me a long time ago, and I tell my kids on a regular basis, in today's society, trust is the most valuable currency that you can have, especially in a world when people are untrustworthy, right? Mm-hmm. But you can spend a lifetime building that trust and earning that trust, and one decision you can destroy it. And then you have to take a whole nother lifetime to build that. So that's what I tell the kids. You spend your life building your reputation of trust, your character more, because my favorite quote is, be more concerned about your character than your reputation, because your character is who you are, and your reputation is who people think you are, right? So if your character is right, then your reputation will blossom over time. So we're starting to see, you know, when I look at what's taken over in Shanghai and they're removing the manipulators from the market, my trust is developing dramatically there, and I'm losing trust here. And that's a big deal from a global standpoint, especially if the BRICS and China are coming out with the unit and they back it with 40% with gold and other consistent measures to have an honest market, a price discovery market. They want the reality of the situation, where we want to have an engineered reality. And an engineered reality is going to come apart at some point in the future when you hit that critical mass.
Well, remind me for next time, I think. So we had a lot of comments under last week's episode at Peak Prosperity, where it was housed, going into 401ks versus Roth versus self-directed versus this versus that. A lot of questions about that. And I'm raising that now because, speaking about this trust issue, you know, the idea is that you have to consider the landscape you're in. So these are taxes today. What might they be in the future? And I'm sure you saw the Netherlands, the House there, I don't think it's full law yet, but they passed this idea that they're going to put a 36% tax on unrealized gains.
Incredible.
It's just the most destructive thing I can imagine. I know people who live there. They're already making plans to leave before they slap an exit tax on them, or you know, some kind of a tentacle to reel you back in for daring to leave their abusive environment, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely incredible, and it's insane.
But the idea is that whatever taxes are today, they may not be that tomorrow. And if you're in New York City, you're figuring this out. If you're in the Netherlands, you're figuring this out. Probably coming soon to a theater near you, because this is just sort of how governments tend to behave. They never go, can I cut expenditures somewhere? Nah. Let's tax the people a little harder. So, yeah, I could see that changing a lot going forward, depending on political circumstances. So,
and another thing I'm concerned about that I want to plant a seed on right now, Mondami has given us an indication. That's a birth pain, if you want to call it, a warning, a shot across the bow as to what's going to happen if that pendulum swings back the other way. So, you know, if Trump hadn't have won, the Democratic side really wanted to go back closer to the 1998 tax code. Not 100%, but for the most part, back to that 1998 tax code. So, you know, if you have a relatively large estate, when I first got in the business, if you had an estate over $1.5-2 million, you had to do some estate planning to keep from paying 50% inheritance tax when you passed away, or estate tax. I am concerned that that's coming back in the future. So people with larger estates need to at least be thinking in that direction and mentally preparing themselves so that they can move quickly. Like, one of the things I did prior to the election is I actually booked some time with some of the attorneys and had some clients that could have been affected from the estate tax standpoint if the election went the other way. Because my argument was, look, if you don't get ahead of this now and at least start thinking about what you want to do so you can move fast, and you don't have some time blocked off for the attorneys from the election to the new year, you have a very short window of time to get in, and you're not going to be able to get in. I'm back to looking over the fact of just how this administration and the Republicans in Congress have not fulfilled the wishes of the people that have supported them. If we swing back the other way, there's a good chance that estate tax limit, which is rather large right now, could be dramatically changed in the future. And that's going to be impactful for the people who aren't ready and at least thinking ahead to prepare for that, to protect from the potential 50% at your death, goes to the government.
Mm-hmm. And of the people I know who, for whom this is actually a real concern because they're over the limit, you have to get involved in trusts, and they have to be structured just the right way, and it's how the cost basis comes in, and there's just a lot of moving pieces to sort of get that right, but really worth it if you're in that exposed category.
Absolutely. And there's really good strategies that are within the law. I mean, the good thing is the extremely wealthy that are putting these into place, build your exit ramps for those who have the ability and to pay for somebody that knows the knowledge, right? So there are all kinds of strategies that can be implemented. And those are things we've helped people out with at the time. But at least for those people that are out there, just keep that in the back of your mind. You know, be thinking, what would I do if this changes dramatically? Because you're going to need to do something to be prudent with the assets that you have and protect yourself from those like the Mandami who wants to take from you and implement socialism.
Indeed. And by the way, we all may gloriously go past these buffer limits simply because we hold an ounce of gold and it's suddenly worth $300,000 or something dumb, you know, or $30 million. Who knows, right? When we get into the late stage of all this. All right. So thank you, everybody, for being here today. And if you want to talk with Paul and or his amazing team, you go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a simple form. Somebody from his office will be in touch with you within 48 business hours to set up the first of three potential calls, an introductory call, a planning call, and then a recommendations call. And then if all that lines up, it might make sense for you two to work together, then that's what would happen. So with that, again, peakfinancialinvesting.com. Paul, thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my honor, Chris. Good to see you.
Until next time, everyone. Bye for now.